Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Prevail. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organizzato, dinero sucio.
Globale corruzione. Та боротьбу за демократію.
E ora?
ATP.
Et maintenant?
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Greg
Oliar.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. The author of a new book called Spiderweb Capitalism, How Global Elites Exploit Frontier Markets, Kimberly K. Hong, is here. Great conversation with her. She basically went undercover and infiltrated the world of high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals for many months, interviewed just, you know, hundreds of people, and came away with an understanding of how that world operates that I think is super valuable. And she likened it to a spider web because the strands of what's going on don't interrelate. The spider that's the little spider that's working on the, you know, the northwest part of the spider web has no idea what's going on in the southeast and so forth. And it's constructed this way by design. And it's constructed this way so that the people doing this basically dirty work can sleep at night and say, well, I was just doing my job. I'm just balancing the books, man. I'm not involved with this you know, this malfeasance or this tax avoidance or whatever. It's a fascinating book. It's a really important look at, you know, how this world operates. It's not a world that most people have access to, and she got access to it. And, you know, great book, great conversation. I look forward to sharing that with you. Before we get to Kimberly, lots of news this week. I find it really fascinating that Trump and Putin are imploding at the same time. Let's start with Putin. You know, he's getting his ass kicked. In this Ukraine invasion is a debacle. It's just a humiliating defeat for him, for Russia, the whole thing. It's exposed them as this paper tiger. They basically don't have any more soldiers or generals or tanks or anything. I mean, it's a joke right now. The Ukrainian counteroffensive last week put them on their heels. Ukraine is reclaiming the territory that Russia took earlier in the war. And so Putin has said, we're going to mobilize the Russian forces. You know, okay. You know, when I was in middle school, we used to have like, you know, these jokes and these barbs that you used to trade with somebody. And someone would say, I'm going to kick your ass, man. And you would say, oh, yeah, you and what army? So I feel like I'm asking Putin the same question. Oh, you're going to come get us? You and what army? Because, dude, you don't have an army. your army invaded Ukraine and got the fucking shit kicked out of it. And now you're calling up basically the equivalent of like my son's high school classmates in Russia who have no desire to be there at all, don't know how to fire weapons, aren't trained, either them or people that are older than me. And you think those people are going to train in your one crappy training site and then go into Ukraine and take it over? Come on. It's a joke. Everyone knows it's ridiculous. And that's why even in Russia, the powers that be are starting to turn on this guy. He knows it. He's a fucking loser. He's also, you know, he's stolen a lot of money from the Russian people. And what needs to happen is after Ukraine liberates the territory that Russia has stolen, I think that money needs to be seized, given to the Russian people and given to the Ukrainian people to pay back them for destroying the cities. You know, this needs to be a catastrophic mistake for Russia, no matter if Putin's there or not. There's no getting around it. And I think Putin knows it. I think he's terrified, and good. I hope he's terrified. And the other point, and I've made this before, I'm going to say it again. The whole like cover story that he sells, oh, NATO is coming for us. We have to defend. Everybody wants to invade Russia. Dude, if anybody gave a shit about invading your crappy country, we would do it right now. When you literally don't have a fucking army. Like me and like 12 guys could invade Russia right now. There ain't nobody there. But you know what? Nobody cares. Nobody wants your shitty country. You can keep your indoor plumbing that doesn't work and all that shit. Just stay there. Nobody cares. Get your people out of Ukraine. Pay them back for the damage you caused. And that's it. And step down. That's it. That's what I've got to say about Putin. Meanwhile, Putin's little buddy in the United States is not faring very well either. This Judge Deary, between Deary and Trusty and Lindell getting busted at Hardee's, there's so many names. I think we're running out of names in the simulation for these people. But Deary turned out to be, I guess, kind of fine. And this special master business seems to be expedited. I'm recording this Wednesday afternoon. By the time you listen to it, who knows, maybe it will be resolved by the 11th Circuit. I hope so. The guy stole documents, classified documents. He stole them. He removed them. He did not give them back. Some of them are missing. The chances that he didn't sell them to somebody are infinitesimal. And that's not his only problem. Tish James, the attorney general in my state of New York, today, this very day, Wednesday, September 21st, dropped the hammer, not only on Trump and his crap-ass company, but his kids, Don Jr., Ivanka, and Eric. Now, those kids, the MAGA idiots, they want to crucify Hunter Biden, right? They want to just throw the book at this guy for, I don't really understand what they think he did, but they want to throw the book at Hunter Biden. But if anybody goes near one of these three kids, it's like, oh, you have to stay away from the children. Like they're, you know, like they're 8 years old or something. You know, they're not. They're grown ass people. They're grown ups. They're adults. They know what they're doing. They made their bed. They lie in the bed. And all of them should be in prison. If what they did is true, and spoiler alert, it is, they got to pay. And that's it. So if she gets what she wants, the Trump org is basically not going to be able to deal in real estate in New York, which, you know, if you're a real estate company, it's probably not great to not be able to deal in real estate. They're going to have a hell of a time getting a bank loan. I don't think they're going to be able to do that. Basically, he's going to shut down all operations for him other than just, I guess, grifting from morons who keep sending this guy money. And honestly, I feel like if people at this point are so stupid that they're going to send Trump more money, I guess just let him, you know, we're going to seize it anyway. I mean, he owes $250 million now. She's going to try to recoup from all this tax stuff. So, you know, these MAGA idiots are going to give Trump money, and that money is either going to pay lawyers or it's going to wind up back in the coffers of the government. So in a sense, these people are just paying a tax, which is they don't want probably. I don't know. Makes my head spin. However, bad week for Putin, bad week for Trump, good week for democracy. Bad week for Pat Sajak, too. don't pose with Marjorie Taylor Greene. That's what are you doing, Pat Sajak? So I don't know if you know, I don't think that the viewership of Wheel of Fortune is gives a shit about this stuff. But I don't know. Maybe it's time for Pat to hang up the old spurs and move on to something else in life. Maybe he can go on. He can go on the War Room and be the host there while Bannon is in the Hooskow. All right, I've prattled on long enough. I want to get to the heart of the matter because this is a really fascinating interview. Kimberly Hong, like I said, infiltrated these spaces. She's done this before. Her first book, she basically researched the sex work industry in Vietnam, Myanmar, and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. That's an interesting book as well. So this is what she does. She infiltrates. I'm using the word infiltrate. That's not the right word. She embeds herself with the groups that she's studying, interviews everybody, observes, and, you know, collects data, and then produces these books about it. Really fascinating stuff. Great conversation. So I'm going to stop talking. We'll be right back with Kimberly K. Hong.
Don't let high prices push you out of the vacation picture. Fly our new one-way fun fares. Whether you're going from San Antonio to Martha's Vineyard, Martha's Vineyard to Cape Cod, or Nashville to Bob Sykes Airport in Okaloosa County, Florida, DeSantis Airlines is the best way to travel. If you're a citizen of Venezuela, you can skip the TSA line and get right on board. Even if you ride coach, you'll be given first-class treatment by Perla, our lone flight attendant and Obergruppenführer. And at DeSantis Airlines, you know the planes run on time. DeSantis Airlines. Fly the fascist skies. And now, back to the show.
Kimberly K. Han, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm super excited to talk to you. You wrote this great new book called Spiderweb Capitalism, How Global Elites Exploit Frontier Markets, which I've read and which is excellent. And I think people listening to this are really going to like it because you sort of attack this dark money thing in a way that I'm very interested in and people listening will be interested in. I want to get to all that, but before we go into the new book, I want people to hear a little bit about you. Now, you're a professor at the University of Chicago, sociology, and you wrote a book called Dealing in Desire, Asian Ascendancy, Western Decline, and the Hidden Currencies of Global Sex Work, which came out in 2015 before Trump when the world was normal. So before we get started, though, tell us a little bit about you. How did you come to be interested in this sort of arcane area of interest?
You know, I fell into it, to be very honest. It's interesting because my first book, Dealing in Desire, is very different from my second book, Spiderweb Capitalism. But from a personal story, there is a narrative arc, which is that my first book, Dealing in Desire, is a story about how the sex industry facilitates foreign investment into frontier economies. And the reason for that is in markets where there is not really clear rule of law or enforcement of contracts, so many deals are done on the basis of a handshake and on having blackmail, right? And so that was the story of the book, Dealing in Desire, because that was a time when we were starting to see the rise of Asia and the decline of the West. It was around the 2008 financial crisis, where a lot of money being poured into Southeast Asia was coming from places like China, South Korea, more developed nations within the region, investing in less developed nations in the region. But then what happened was that that was based off of an ethnography where I worked actually as a hostess inside of four different bars. And I did kind of really a deep dive ethnography. I was a hostess for 15 months, basically, drinking, singing, dancing, all of that with the women as a way of trying to understand this economy. But there were limits there in that I couldn't really see what was happening outside of the hostess bars. And so that sort of led me to the second project. And initially, I was really interested in a smaller question, which is sort of how do Western investors who are constrained by the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, particularly US investors, how do they navigate this market differently from Chinese investors or South Korean investors whose governments don't enforce any kinds of foreign bribery laws abroad? And as I started doing research for that second book, trying to answer a much smaller question, this kind of web started to unfold in front of me. And I started to follow the pieces of the puzzle as they were unfolding. And it took me a long time to put it together. But I think that's sort of the story of how I go from the first to the second book. I mean, I think at heart, I'm an ethnographer. I'm really interested in people. I'm really interested in how people make markets, how people make decisions, how the markets move through emotion, through decision-making, through relationships, and not just through a set of algorithms.
What does that mean, ethnography, like in very specific terms?
I mean, ethnography in very specific terms is about interviewing people, following people, observing relationships between people to try to understand, you know, a phenomenon. So, you know, ethnography has a lot of times been used, most often been used to study down. And what I mean by that is studying poorer populations. I think of classic ethnographies like, you know, Lawrence Ralph's book, Renegade Dreams, or Forrest Stewart's book, Down Out Under Arrest, or Ballad of the Bullet, which are typically ethnographies of gangs, you know, and it really actually does come out of the Chicago school of urban ethnography. I kind of take that and use it to study elites and say, well, yeah, you can spend an intense amount of time in, you know, the south side of Chicago, but you can and trying to understand the informal sort of gang drug economy there. But then you could also use it to study up. And what does that look like? And how do we do that? And so it's really about just spending a lot of time with people, interviewing people, following people around, shadowing people in their daily lives, and trying to put together their relationships with one another.
That's fascinating. And it comes out in both of the books. So, all right, now you spent years now of your life infiltrating isn't the right word, but I'm going to use it anyway. Infiltrating first sex workers and that world, and then high net worth individuals and that world in places like Vietnam and places like Myanmar. So let's just acknowledge here that that's kind of badass. Even though you're coming from this ivory tower place, what you've done is, you know, somebody says in the book, you're very brave.
I try to be very careful with that, because I think a lot of ethnography is voyeuristic, in that it sort of is like, look at me, I'm a badass, and let me tell you a story of what I did. And I guess the reason why I shy away from that is because I come from a very working class background. And I think that I'm very careful not to exoticize the poor. And then similarly, I don't want to exoticize the rich either, because so much of ethnography on the wealthy is voyeuristic. It's like, we're so obsessed with like, how do they spend their money? How do they consume? And I'm really interested in like, no, how do they make their money? How do they protect their wealth and their reputations? And not just take for granted that they are the tastemakers of the, you know, of the world. Like, how did they get there? And I guess, you know, certainly I didn't put myself in the safest places, and there were things that I did that were risky, both in the first book and in the second book. You know, in the first book, I worked in these bars. I drank 12 hours a day for months on end. I did everything to try to lose. I mean, but I think that for me, the data is what really matters, and trying to understand people outside of tropes and stereotypes is really important. And the only way to do that is to really embed yourself in these social spaces, to be able to present a kaleidoscope view, and to be able to write about people as multidimensional characters instead of as tropes. I feel like the only way to do that is to really dig deep and go far. And sometimes we don't always know how far we've gone when we're doing that work. But I don't want to exoticize it either.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job of drawing the line there, because when you read the stuff, it gets to where you want it to go, which is that it does feel like this great survey of what's going on, rather than a, hey, look at how cool I am, which a lot of, like, for example, war reporting is like that. If you read like war books, there's all these guys that are clearly in very dangerous places, and they seem to, you know, they want you to know how dangerous it is. And this stuff isn't like that at all. Not even remotely. That's why I felt the need to acknowledge it up front, because, you know, respect, basically. So I thought it was also interesting looking at the two books and the subjects of the two books, you know, sex workers in one and that part of the economy, and then high net worth individuals as opposed to ultra high net worth individuals, which we'll get to in a second. Mm-hmm. And both of them are people that cater to people richer than them for money and will do, you know, basically what they're told for money. Did you see similarities in, if not what they're doing physically, what the mindset?
You know, you're the first person that's asked me this question, and I love this question.
Oh, good. Okay.
And because it's the first time that I've had to really think on my feet in that way, which is that what I think is so interesting about the question that you're asking is that both of them are prostituting themselves for something.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the reason why I think that question is so, I mean, I wish I had this conversation before I just put in my dossier for promotion to Fold, and that's a really good narrative arc. I didn't put it in there. The reason why I think about that actually is when all of the stuff about Jeffrey Epstein came out and all of the powerful people that were embedded in that network, it reminds me a lot of the story that I tell between these two books, which is that from where I come from, I was very naive when I started the research for this book. And frankly, naive as an assistant professor at the University of Chicago, because you know, the university, the social world that I'm in an elite university is also embedded in these spaces. And I didn't quite understand the difference between, you know, ultra wealthy individuals and the people who are highly compensated individuals who are the fall people who do a lot of this work. I often thought about the high net worth individuals as the really rich people. And you know, when I think about that, they're taking reputational risks, criminal risks. They're actually engaged in health risks. Like some of these men, not all, but some of these men participate in the sex industry in a very Jeffrey Epstein type of way, as a way to build relationships of trust but also create relationships of mutual hostage among each other, like having dirt on each other, getting, you know. And so I do think that there is a similarity. And what's ironic about your question, and this actually goes back, people, when I've given talks in academic settings about this book before, I, you know, as a way to get feedback and think through the theory, the one question that I often get asked is like, how did you get access to all of these people for the second book? And you know, what's really interesting, which is an answer to this question that you had, is that most of the people had done their due diligence on me. They're highly educated, very intelligent people. And they read either the introduction to my first book or a news article somewhere in Vietnamese or in English, very quick thing. And when I would go to do some of these interviews with my research assistants, who are primarily University of Chicago undergraduate students, I would say to the students, okay, we have to do all this work of like asking dumb questions, warming them up before we can dig in. And all of us were surprised. Sometimes when we sit down in an interview and they would say, hey, I saw what you did for your first book. I know you know how this works. What do you want to know? And then they would just like pour out all of this stuff. And so I don't think that my second book would have been possible if I hadn't established myself with my first book and done the quote unquote dirty work for my first book, because there was a certain kind of mutual understanding that we both understood each other, and we were like doing parallel things in different spaces. And that really opened up Pandora's box for me for this second book.
Yeah, you established your bona fides. I say it, but I know it's not really pronounced that way, but that's how I pronounce it, bona fides. And I think these people want to brag a little bit about the stuff they've done. And who do you talk to? I mean, there's only so many people that even appreciate what it is that they've done and can get it. So I'm sure that if I was us, I would be delighted to talk to somebody who knew what the hell I was talking about. Would make my day. I want to get into the new book now. Before, I always forget to take a break, so we're going to take a break early so that I don't forget. We'll be right back with Kimberly K. Hahn.
Men cannot know the anguish of being ruled ineligible on anatomical grounds beyond one's control. Slaves can perhaps understand, eunuchs too, and perhaps even those doomed nobles like the deposed Emperor Romanos Diogenes, whose eyes have been put out, but not men.
This podcast is brought to you by Empress, The Secret History of Anna Kay, the new book by Greg Oliar, now available on Amazon.
If the truth is ever to be told, I am the only one left to tell it, and tell it I must.
Okay, we're back with Kimberly K. Hahn. I want to get into the new book, which is called Spiderweb Capitalism. I think the key to understanding how the book is set up is this metaphor that you've drawn into the title with the spiders and the webs. Talk a little bit about that. I think it's a perfect metaphor for what you've got going on here. So enlighten everybody what you
need. Yeah. So I think that, you know, spiderweb capitalism is something that emerged for me as I was putting the pieces of the puzzle together. So the way that I think about it is that It's a network. It's a web, and it's a financial network web, a financial web of people. And so I started to theorize it as a spider web, because it's a capital web, a financial webs, in that there are different kinds of people who are putting these financial webs together. And I actually drew inspiration from a group of social spiders, because it turns out if you just Google massive spider webs, you can find this particular group of social spiders who build out these massive webs. And they work in community with each other. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is the story there. And so the way that I kind of take it further in theorizing it is that there are big spiders who I refer to as the ultra high net worth individuals, and then the sort of small spiders who are the high net worth individuals. And basically what it is that the small spiders are putting this big spider's money to work by weaving the connective silk that puts the web together. But the webs are so complicated, and they're 3D, and they're all over the place, and they're not, you can't replicate the different webs, because what it does is it obfuscates each of the financial professionals' relationship with one another from each other. And what I think is fascinating about this is that there's lawyers, there's finance, there's fund managers, there's bankers, there's company secretaries, there's the, you know, ultra high net worth individuals who are employing all of these people, but they are so specialized in the thing that they're doing to build out different parts of the web that they have plausible deniability in their relationships with one another. So what it is it's a system that features a complex web of subsidiaries that are interconnected across multiple sovereignties, and I think are, one, hard to identify, and two, hard to quantify. And so what they do is they use offshore financial centers to enable both economic and political elites who, in less developed economies, but I would also argue in recent years under the Trump administration, also in developed economies, to basically secure exclusive access to insider deals for the sort of private accumulation of wealth. And so what is really interesting in the way that I think about it is that there is the ultra wealthy and the wealthy that are not just within nation. And so it's not like, oh, the, you know, billionaires of the United States decide that they want to go and make investments in frontier markets, and so the foreign investment goes from the United States to Vietnam or Myanmar. It actually runs through this very complicated web of subsidiaries that are offshore in the British Virgin Islands and Panama, Cayman Islands, Seychelles, that are then directed into other offshore entities in Hong Kong or in Singapore before they're invested onshore in Vietnam and Myanmar. And the reason why that's so important is, one, it's legal. These are legal structures, even if people think that they're morally reprehensible. But the other is that it enables the ultra wealthy to see the whole world as their playground and to choose the legal jurisdictions that govern their financial activities. And so by mapping out sort of the people and the structure of the web, I kind of show how increasingly in this global economy, frontier markets are tethered to developed markets. And actually, what's really interesting is, as I was doing research for this book, I started to meet a number of institutional investors on the ground in Vietnam and Myanmar. And the first thing they would say to me is, oh, everybody's embedded in this market. Like, go look at your retirement account. And around 2016, 2017, I looked at my retirement account, which is TIA, CREF, you know, a university. And guess what? 25% of the portfolio is invested in emerging and developing markets. So in many ways, there's a way in which these financial webs are all interconnected, but it's just very hard to see how they're interconnected and to see this as systemic rather than as like individual villains as part of a story.
Yeah. There's a lot to unpack there. We were talking before we turned the camera on about Oliver Bullough's book, which is called Moneyland. And it's the same what you just described about these ultra high net people who kind of go from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. He calls them moneylanders, which is a good, I think, name for it.
I like that.
And the idea of going from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, because there's certain countries where, you know, for example, in Great Britain, libel law is much more easy. It's easier to sue somebody for libel in London than it is in New York. So these people will go there when they're doing lawsuits of that kind, and stuff is easier to hide when it's in Delaware versus New York, let's say. So they'll go to Delaware to incorporate all of their things that are incorporated in the United States. And then maybe the returns on banks are better in country X, and they'll go there to do that. And the banking secrecy laws are better in Luxembourg or whatever. So this is sort of what you're getting at. What you said about the ultra high net worth individuals versus the high net worth individuals, as you're talking, it reminded me of this Chris Rock line where he was talking about the difference between being rich and being wealthy, where he's like, Shaquille O'Neal is rich, but the guy who signs his check, he's wealthy. Yeah. You know, and I think that's the thing. You see these, yeah, like any of these high net worth individuals, to pretty much anyone listening to this, are just like super loaded, like have more money than I'll ever have in my life.
Yes.
Why can't they be happy? But in fact, they are functionaries.
Yes.
To these much more wealthy people who are truly liberated to some degree, although I suspect a lot of these people aren't very happy either. Certainly the rich people that we know about don't seem, Elon Musk doesn't seem like he's happy to me. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't seem like this paragon of good mental health. So one of the chapters in your book, you talk about corruption and bribery. And mm-hmm. I think this is really important, because there a certain, you know, in a sense, it's what's the word? It's semantics, right? Is it corruption? Is it bribery? Is it, I'm just going to donate a lot of money to Joe Manchin so that he votes yes on the coal stuff. You know, every country has relationships like this and ways that you can influence and lobby the key players. But in the emerging markets, apparently, I think it's less structured, less regulated, and therefore less prone to just good old fashioned, here's $20. I want the best table in the back, but super large. But the United States has laws against this. Other places don't. One of the key ideas in your book is the idea of playing in the gray, which is something that somebody told you, I think, early on in the interview process, which I interpret to mean sort of in this area where it's not illegal, but it's not legal. We don't really know. Fuck it. Let's move ahead until somebody tells us not to. Is that?
Yes. Yes. That's such a great way of describing it. You know, actually, the initial title of the book was Playing in the Gray.
I thought it would be. Yeah. A good title, too.
It ended up not being the title, because it turns out the gray is complicated to publish in the US market versus the UK market, because it's spelled differently.
Oh, yep. Yeah, you're right. But you spell it the American way, by the way.
I do. Right. Yeah. But, you know, it's a language that it came up over and over again in the interviews that I was doing, which is it's what people are doing when they're finessing this gray space between legal and illegal activity. And clearly, you know, what is legal in one jurisdiction is not legal in another jurisdiction. And how do you navigate that? And when you go to emerging markets, you know, you're kind of etching into there from developed economies. And when you go into frontier markets like Vietnam and Myanmar, you're really in a new frontier. And Vietnam is kind of hovering between frontier and emerging market. And so it's an interesting place to look at vis-a-vis China and Myanmar, you know, even in terms of thinking about what it means to play in the gray in those spaces. But in the book, when I talk about, you know, varieties of corruption and bribery, I think it's really interesting, because so much of the work that's done by political scientists looks at corruption from the position of state officials, right? Like being on the side of receiving bribes or whatever. But it doesn't actually look at how people are paying those bribes, the sort of looking at the economic side of it, or the financial, you know, looking at how financial professionals carry this out. And what I think is interesting is that there's degrees of gray in thinking about different types of corruption, right? So there is, you know, first of all, when in these, both of these economies, everyone would say corruption is rampant. And that's a kind of a taken for granted thing. It's in the news, it's in the media. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial when I say that these are highly corrupt economies. But what's interesting is, I think that it's important to think about this corruption along a continuum where, okay, so if you have highly inefficient bureaucracies where it's difficult to get licensing or permits or to get your business registered, and you go to, you know, X state office to register your business for a license or permit, and you, you know, slip a $100 bill or $20 bill to get the bureaucrat to move more quickly on your file, people would call that a facilitation payment, which actually is legal under many other jurisdictions, right? Like there are several countries, even in the United States, that's not considered illegal activity, right? But if you're paying someone to, you know, but if you're engaged in bribery where you are, you know, gifting cash to get access to an insider deal, that's a one other end, right, of the continuum. But there's also people get creative, right? And so instead of just giving straight cash, they give very personalized and intimate kinds of gifts. And what I talk about in the book are like things like Rolex watches and Hermes handbags that are coveted stores, art, things that are coveted items that are hard to get that you can personalize, but that are stores of value that can be quickly transferred to cash if needed. And then it's a question of, is that a gift or is that a bribe? And, you know, things like, you know, scholarships to for your child to study, for somebody's child to study abroad, all kinds of workarounds. And then, you know, it also gets into some things that came up recently with JP Morgan, where, you know, it was in Hong Kong, it was known as the Sons and Daughters Program, where one thing that's very common in these economies is to hire the sons and daughters or the close family members of public officials to work as consultants in your office. And their job is to help navigate government relations. Are they providing a certain kind of expertise? On the ground, people would say, yes, this is part of a joint venture. Outside, they would say this is bribery, corruption. But then again, whose jurisdiction are we talking about? Because in the local market, it wouldn't be considered corruption. But in a foreign market, it might be. And so I think that what the book is trying to get at are these like variations of gray that give plausible deniability and that obfuscate the bribe.
Yeah. It's good that we live in the United States where stuff like that never happens. Politicians' kids have never been hired by any company to do anything. It's never it's never happened before. Lord knows it makes these MAGA people nuts. They can't get over the Hunter Biden thing. It's just because this one company hired him. Didn't help. Okay, so tax strategies. That's another part of your book. And I think, you know, when we talk about inequality and, you know, the money moving around in my mind, and maybe I don't understand it as well as you do, obviously, but the thing that bothers me about this isn't the money going into the emerging markets. It's good that we're investing money in Vietnam and Myanmar. That's great. You know, we should be doing that. Capital flowing from the United States to developing markets is good for everybody in that very pure capitalistic sense. The problem is that none of the shit gets taxed. That's the problem. Yeah. So you have money that leaves the accounting of all this global stuff, and it just vanishes from the tax ledger. And that to me is the problem. That's what creates the inequality. In Bulow's book, he differentiates between dirty money, which is the money from the actual criminals, you know, some oligarch that just steals money from Moldova or something, versus naughty money, he calls it, which is people kind of hiding and trying to skirt tax laws, often perfectly legally, but not morally great. So what kinds of things are these people up to, and what can we do to make them pay?
I think that's a really hard question because, first of all, one of the things I talk about in the book is that strategies of tax evasion and tax avoidance are essentially functional equivalents where one is illegal and the other is legal. And most firms start out engaging in practices of tax evasion until they grow large enough where they have enough assets that they can hire out the big accounting firms to develop strategies for tax avoidance. But they're functional equivalents. I mean, they're essentially this one and the same. I think that Gabriel Zuckman and sort of crew of economists have started to try to tackle this issue by saying that we need to have a global wealth registry, and also that we need to have clearer transfer pricing laws between countries. And so what you started to see are countries like the United States and Western Europe putting in laws around transfer pricing practices. That's fine, but then those same practices move to China. And then in the markets that I study, Vietnam and Myanmar, they're just piggybacking off of what China was doing and copycatting China and India, and moving basically to greater frontier economies as to basically run transfer pricing practices before the regulators get a handle on them. And, you know, there was a big public story in the media when, you know, Grab Taxi bought Uber in Southeast Asia and the state was trying to tax them and they couldn't figure out how to tax them because all of the entire transaction was booked offshore. And I think that that's a really good public example of the ways in which these one offshore structures, but also transfer pricing strategies make it difficult for governments to tax these kinds of transactions. It's a high level example, but it happens often, you know, in a very mundane way at a lower example. One thing that happens is that firms often book their liabilities onshore. So they say, oh, we're just sending money down to cover operations. We're like, you know, everything is so costly. So it's a kind of an accounting strategy of basically saying they're reporting losses onshore where they're higher taxes, but reporting all of their profits offshore where they're lower, where they're in lower tax jurisdictions like Singapore, Hong Kong, BVI, et cetera. I think what's really challenging, and people often ask me, like, what do we do about this? And I say, and you know, Gabriel Zuckman and all say, well, we have to have this global wealth registry. And if the United States and Western Europe participated in it, that would account for 50% of all sort of global GDP. And I guess my response to that is a little bit more pessimistic coming from Southeast Asia, which is that, right, but that assumes that the United States isn't, it doesn't have this like very complicated geopolitical relationship with China and Russia, because Russia and China point their fingers right back to the United States and Delaware, which you mentioned, as citing Delaware as the biggest gangsters on the block who actually don't report the financial activity that's happening offshore for China and Russia in Delaware. And Hal Weitzman wrote this book, What's the Matter with Delaware, which came out with Princeton University Press, which I would really like to plug here because Hal Weitzman makes this very bold statement about Delaware and the lack of reporting between, you know, the United States, Russia, and China. And so I think that there, what's laid over this are the very geopolitical tensions between countries that make it such that they're not going to engage in this kind of we can't successfully have a global wealth registry unless there is cooperation and peace across these different nation states.
Right. So we can't very well be the ones to say, hey, stop doing this when we're doing it worse than anybody in Delaware and South Dakota and stuff.
That's what Hal Weitzman would say. I didn't have the audacity to say that in my book.
your book, there is a little part about Delaware. It only touches on it. I think it's interesting. I mean, Delaware is, I remember years ago, 20 years ago, somebody wrote something in the New Republic calling Delaware just ripping on it, how awful it was and, you know, pirating money, even the throughway that goes, not the throughway, the turnpike, you know, 95 that goes through Delaware is there for like 12 miles or something. And they exact so many tolls from it that it pays for all the other highways in the state and stuff like that. I can't remember who wrote the article, but it still holds up. Now, of course, one of Delaware's senators is our president, which is also kind of funny.
This is what I think. This is, but I want to say this too, because one of the things I opened my book up with is the story of 1MDB. And I tell the story about how, you know, Joe Lowe funneled money into both Trump victory and Black men vote in Trump victory. And, you know, what I think, what I want to be really clear about is that it's a bipartisan problem. Like, yes. It's not me being a Democrat pointing my fingers at the Trump administration when Biden hails from Delaware. And if there's anybody who knows anything about the structure of Delaware and the structure of offshore entities, it's Biden, but they're not doing anything. And the reason why they're not doing anything, I think, it's systemic. It's that the political sphere and economic sphere are so tightly woven, even in the United States, that we're not seeing this, that we're not seeing the kind of regulatory structures that we would hope to see in place, because essentially it's asking the regulators to regulate themselves, not just abroad, but also here in the U.S.
There's another kind of key point there in the point that you are piggybacking on the point that you just made, which is that because these little spiders and the people that are making their little section of the web, because it's so isolated, they're like the people in Severance who are down on the severed floor playing with the numbers. They don't really know what they're doing. They just know I'm going to do this specific job and then I'm punching out the clock and, you know, I'm fine. I'm good. They don't see the big picture. So here is a quote from your book. Spiderweb capitalism is designed to hide the consequences of individuals' actions in producing inequality. The problem, you say, is systemic, and that's it. It's by design. It's, I'm not doing anything wrong. All I'm doing is balancing these books here, but all of it is part of this enormous puzzle that boosts money from, you know, people that need it, basically.
Yeah. I really appreciate you picking that up, because you're one of the few people that kind of gets the argument that it's systemic. Oftentimes people ask me, like, okay, who's the villain in the story? You know, and I will say, right, with Occupy Wall Street, it was very easy to figure out who the villains were. It were the financial executives of all of these firms. You could name them, like Countrywide's person, you know, Anthony Mozilla, all of these people. I think that what is so important about this is that there is no villain. And, you know, speaking very humbly about the process of doing research, particularly as a woman trying to study mostly men in finance, is that it's very hard to study experts. And there were, you know, people were not nice, and they were often condescending, and they were often like, are you an economist? What are you doing? Or I was like a cute teacher wanting to try to understand what they were doing. And there was advantages to that, because it got people to say a lot of things that they probably wouldn't otherwise say to my male colleagues at Booth. However, one of the things that I think is just really interesting was that I often thought, like, what they're experts in their domains, right? Like, I'm not going to know more than a lawyer who's highly specialized in putting together these contracts. I'm never going to know more than the banker that's doing their quote unquote, you know, do your due diligence in KYC or know the client. Like, and so I often thought, like, what is a sociologist's add value here? Like, what do I bring to the table? And it was in the comments that they kept saying, like, well, yeah, I do my highly specialized task, but I don't really know what that person is doing over there, and I don't want to know. And it was actually the lawyers who kind of turned me onto this, because it was the lawyers that asked me, do you know what a special purpose vehicle is? Do you know what a holding company is? And I said, no, I don't. Can you please tell me what it is? That's what thrust me into the world of offshore. But what was interesting was that the lawyers who were setting up the structures onshore in Vietnam and Myanmar were different from the lawyers who were setting up the structures offshore in Hong Kong and Singapore. And while they knew of each other, they didn't know what the other person was doing. And they purposely didn't want to know what each other was doing. And so it wasn't just that, I mean, it was the lawyers that really taught me how they obfuscate their relationships with one another in the web, but that opened my eyes to the ways in which bankers and other financial professionals do it. And so ultra high net worth individuals have so much plausible deniability. When I think of the case of 1MDB, the fall person in 1MDB was Timothy Leisner, who has this high profile because he's married to Kimora Lee Simmons, right? But nobody talks about Timothy Leisner as the fall person. Nobody talks about Michael Cohen as Trump's fall person. Like, behind that fall person is this big spider, is this ultra high net worth individual who reaps all of the financial rewards and assumes no criminal or financial risks in these kinds of deal making and risky investments.
We're seeing it now with Trump, with the insurrection stuff, and even with the FBI stuff. Like, he doesn't send emails. He only calls people on the phone and shouts to them and stuff like that. So there's enough plausible deniability to make it so that, you know, he can say, I didn't do anything. It's these horrible people that are working for me. Never mind that he hired them and picked them for their criminality, but whatever. There's a story, I think I got this from the Winds of Change podcast, about there's a fable about the elephant, you know, where it's like blind men. I'm going to totally mangle this. It's blind men touching the elephant, and one blind man, you know, only knows the elephant's trunk, and the other one only knows the hindquarters, and someone else only knows the tail. So that each one of these people has a very specific idea of what the elephant looks like, but nobody knows because they can't see it, because they can't see the whole elephant. They only know the piece that they're working on. And, you know, that's what your book is also trying to do, is see, you know, showing us what the damn elephant looks like. It looks like a spider. We're getting our animals mixed up, but that's okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I only came to that when I had, after doing so many interviews, I was asked to present some of this work back to a handful of financial firms where I had done some of these interviews. And I remember presenting, and I was very nervous because I thought, like, oh my gosh, they're going to find sort of the piece of yarn that's going to unravel the entire ball, and I'm going to have to go back and do more interviews, and this book is going to take me a lot longer. And it did take me a lot longer than it took me 2 to 3 more years than I thought in my head when I started out with this project. And what was really fascinating for one was that people were like, the reaction was, wow, nobody's put this together for me to see. Like, and the reason why they haven't is because they don't have the time. I mean, no one has the luxury of time to sit and think about their relationships with one another. But the other was that, you know, none of them pushed back. They were like, this is totally accurate. But again, because I don't really know what's happening over there, I don't know what these other people are doing, I'm not the villain of the story. And the other thing that I think people would say too is that, well, and my husband and I got into this conversation of the chicken and egg, right? Like, cause I can't answer this question. I actually don't know the answer, which is it that ultra high net worth individuals know all of these practices, or is it that, because what they will say is, oh, it's just my money. But, you know, financial professionals tell me, the lawyers, they're specialized. They tell me what to do. They are the ones that put it all together. The bankers are the ones that like tell me how to set up all these structures. It's like taxes. Like you just go to your accountant and your accountant tells you what to do, right? And then the financial professionals would say, well, yeah, but they're also directing how they want their money invested, where they want their money invested. And if they say they want to go into these new frontiers because they're are lucrative opportunities, they're high risk, potentially high return on investment, then we have to set up these structures this way. And so even for them, they can't point the finger at any, you know, there's no one villain. And I think that was what took me forever to write this book, because I was trying to figure out how to tell the story to tell one that's systemic, which I know is not popular because everybody wants a villain to go after.
Yeah, it's hard to tell a story without a villain. A good villain goes a long way, but you know, we don't know who the villain is, but we do know who the victims are, and the victims, the prey, as you put it, is everybody else.
Yeah,
you know, we all suffer because of these greedy MFers. You know, that's really the truth of what goes on. So I want to ask a little bit about just the psychology of some of this stuff. Like, okay, so for you now, you're here, you're spending a lot of time talking to these people who are enormously, grotesquely wealthy. When I lived in New York City, which I did for 10 years, it was impossible to go around and not be aware constantly of how little money I had compared to anyone else, right? Like, so did that get to you? Did it bother you? Or was it not a thing? Or were you grateful? Like, did it affect you at all? I guess is my question.
Yeah, I would be lying if I said it didn't affect me. You know, I think that ethnographies, as a method, are deeply, it's kind of akin to method acting in a way. Like you really, if to do it well, you have to embed yourself into their social world. You have to have empathy. You have to, and you develop tastes and ways of language, things that draw, it's a way of relating to people and getting and drawing, you know, being for them to trust you and get them to say things, you know. And I think that, you know, I had just moved to the University of Chicago, which is a very elite academic institution that where many of these people come from. And if I'm to be honest, the University of Chicago's business school has a reputation in the financial world of being highly theoretical. And Harvard and Wharton have reputations of being highly corrupt in these markets. And to no surprise, Trump comes from Wharton. I mean, I don't know why I was surprised. I mean, this is what people were saying to me before Trump. This was in 2016, 2017 when I was doing these interviews. But so I had moved into this kind of elite space and I started following people around, and my tastes changed. It's funny because a friend of mine who's an academic was like, oh, you know, you post all these like fancy meals on Instagram and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, there was a time in my life where I found that to be very seductive. Like I got super rich data sitting in a 3-hour, 16 course meal with somebody, right? Like they're stuck there with you. You're stuck there with them. It's an intimate setting. You know, there were very tricky settings. I'm married. And so I had to be like, how do I get to the end of this 3-hour dinner and pay for the meal so that they know that this isn't a date? You know, I mean, but there is something that's very seductive about like doing interviews in airplanes and being thrust into their world of, you know, leisure and actually leisure at a discount, because the economy of free and highly discounted things is one I was totally thrust into. I mean, my whole wardrobe changed. I had, you know, hand-me-down clothes from some of these men's wives when we were traveling together. And they're like, you totally look like a nerdy academic and you don't fit. If you're going to follow us in this entourage, you cannot look like this. And so, you know, there's no way that I didn't change as a result of it. Now that I've had some distance and because of COVID and because I was writing and I was like, wow, I don't enjoy, maybe I grew out of that. I don't enjoy those things the way that I did back then. So I would be lying if I didn't say I wasn't changed by it or that I didn't find it alluring in some way. I mean, I also am very privileged in the space. I don't think people would have talked to me the same way they did if I didn't come. I started out doing this project as an assistant professor at Boston College. Nobody would talk to me. I knocked on so many doors. And Boston College, you know, it's a private elite institution. A lot of financial professionals send their kids there. But there's something about being at the University of Chicago, or I mean, certainly if I was at Harvard or Princeton, like there's something about that that opened up a lot of doors and people were willing to speak more candidly. I hail from an institution that espouses free market economics, right? Like This is that space. And so I think that I grew up with the project in a different way. I mean, ethnography changes you. My first book, I think doing the dirty work and being, you know, in some ways prostituting myself for data, if there's an analogy, right? And in my second book, I had made it. I got this like cushy tenure track position, was hanging out with all of these really wealthy people. They weren't not always nice. They were mean, they were condescending, they were yelling at me. It was humiliating for my male undergraduate research assistants to listen to some of these interviews and transcribe them. But now that it's done, I realize that there's power in that data and that there's power in, you know, being humiliated in front of some of these students. So I think that, you know, one of the things though, is that it helped me have empathy for some of them, because for many, so the last chapter of the book, which, you know, people never really get to when they read a book, and I fully aware of that, is the exit. And it's a story of feast and famine.
That's the last question on my list, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I hope I'm not getting at it too early, but it gets at the psychology of what happens when you make a lot of money and what happens when you lose a lot of money and the ways in which it changes your psychology. Like suddenly it's, and I think about this, the other day I said to a friend of mine, Rachel Sherman has this book, Uneasy Street, which is about sort of a wealthy group of people in New York. And one of the stories, and it's actually a very interesting book, but one of the things that she talks about sort of like this ultra, they're really high net worth individuals, is sort of these renovation projects that they constantly buying houses, and you have this like male partner who's working and a female partner who's at home. And she's like doing this constant, you know, renovation. And it's like those things, you get introduced into their world of furniture and tastes and luxury and all that, and markers, right? Like what is Nouveau Riche brands and what are the things like the Wrangler jeans in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, right? Like all of these subtle markers that you start to notice and pay attention to, but that they are also very keenly aware of. And that while they pretend like they're not paying attention to it, definitely are. And I think that it's, you know, it's the psychology of what was really interesting to me is like when people made a lot of money in these markets, they ironically were very lonely. And Mario Small wrote this book, Someone to Talk To. And I think it's interesting because it's like people who you would think are very successful, who would have all of these people around them, didn't really have people to share it with, including their own spouses. And there were stories of like, oh, well, my wife just, she just expects a certain kind of standard of living. And as long as I provide that, like, she doesn't need to know all of this. If I, you know, and like very expensive, like, you know, I would go with them to shop for very expensive jewelry, like diamond rings, like Van Cleef, like things I didn't have no exposure to or didn't know about before. In spending time with them, and it's like, oh, this is what I do. Like, that's all she cares about. As long as I can provide this lifestyle, it doesn't matter that I just closed a deal and made $200 million. You know what I mean? And then on the other hand, those that lost a lot of money on the market, ironically, had a lot of people to talk to. Their public relations agents, their lawyers, their therapists who are all around the world, and had a broader community to draw on as they were going through this, and were able to kind of bounce back from it and demonstrate a certain kind of resiliency in the market. Because I do think it's important to talk about the economic precarity that they feel, even if they're really, it's like what you said about Elon. I mean, it's like, even though they're very, very rich and they have what I think of as fuck you money, like, you know, they're not worried about their day-to-day bills. There's a certain kind of economic precarity that they feel in going into these frontier markets, in making risky bets in these kinds of markets. And there's certainly winners and losers. And so it, there is a psychology to it, for sure. And I am really interested in the people and how they make sense of the ways that they navigate playing in the gray and also their experiences of feast and famine.
It's interesting, the feast and famine. I think it's a lose-lose in some sense because, you know, the people that win, as you said, they're lonely. And they're lonely because they have so much freaking money that everybody they meet is aware of that. And on some level, they know that or suspect that the person's only wants to talk to them because they have all this money.
Yes.
And what does that do to your psychology? On the other hand, the people that fail have failed. And it sucks to, you know, I'm not a gambler at all because, losing money gambling is like the worst feeling. It just is horrible. It's much worse than winning, you know.
Yeah.
And to go through something like that, and you're in these emerging markets, and, you know, we put fancy words on stock market and all this kind of stuff, but it's all gambling. It's just legalized gambling. That's all that it is. When you put money in a place like Myanmar and then the government falls, well, what do you do? You know, I'm reading this book now about the post-World War II sort of spy networks and stuff like that. And so much of what happened was because Nazis were trying to get their money safely out of country A and move it to country B. It's all about shit. All of our fortune is behind enemy lines. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah.
And like, you know, hey, that's not a problem that I have. So. But you know, that was a great answer that you gave about the exposure to the rich people. What you've learned is what Milton Friedman knew, you know, the University of Chicago, that there is no free lunch and there is no free 17 course dinner either, apparently. So,
yeah.
thank you for laughing. Are Wrangler jeans really hip now? Is that true?
I think among the very wealthy, that I study, they're very, it's interesting because I, you know, my taste had changed and I was like, I like designer things. This feels nice. And they're like, oh no, that's like nouveau riche. Like, you know, it's very understated. And frontier, you know,
yeah,
I think
frontier.
It's a new frontier actually.
Okay. No, it's interesting to me. It's not something I keep up on. I'm not a fashion plate by any means. I do know that Rolex watches suck and everybody that is actually rich does not wear a Rolex, you know, because they know that there's other ones that are better. That's a brand you wear to show off your nouveau richeness, or maybe has it flipped now? Has it come all the way full circle where everybody knows that?
I think it's interesting because I was at this wealth and inequality conference, and I do think that there's a difference between the ultra wealthy in the West and the ultra wealthy in East and Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Because there's a certain kind of display of money that in the West you would associate with nouveau riche, but that really only the sons and daughters of billionaires can afford to do. I mean, it's interesting that kind of display, because, and I'm very cognizant of it as I travel between places, because things that would be more subdued in the US side, for example, like that Rolex watch or that, you know, that Hermes handbag or whatever, is very much in your face in Asia. And all of those brands have since moved many of their flagship stores to those countries. And you can see crazy sales in those countries because that's the thing there. And one could call that new money in Southeast Asia, but I do think that even the Western investors that are making their way to those markets, you see them carrying those things over there in ways that they don't over here. People code switch in a global space in a way that I think also is fascinating.
Ooh, I like code switch. That's good. I like that. That's a good, I've never heard that before.
But the thing I will say really quickly about Rolex watches is that there is even among them, I can't remember, but there's like something like, there is the Rolex watch that you can go in and buy, and then there's the one that you have to be offered to buy. I can't remember what the brand, but the name is. But it's the same as the handbags, right? Like you have to be offered, you have to have a relationship with a sales associate. And so it's those watches that they're really paying attention to, not the
Not the ones the hoi polloi have, you know, yeah. Anybody. Yeah. it is funny. I got my wife a Prada handbag for her birthday last year, and I got it because I got a really, really good deal on it. But it's very lovely. And she went to Asheville, North Carolina with the handbag. And she was like, everyone was so nice to me whenever I went into the stores. Like, they just were like, oh, here we go. She must have money, you know, and they were fooled.
That's really, you know, what's so funny. I feel like maybe we are like kindred spirits, because as I was doing this research, one of the very wealthy people that I was studying actually owned a franchise. And I got a lot of high-end things at 90% off, essentially, so that I could like dress appropriately. And what I developed is my own taste was Prada, because I thought it was understated. It kind of fit the professor look, and it felt authentic to me, but then also wasn't so loud like the other labels in terms of having labels all over. So it's interesting.
Yeah, the leather is extremely nice. It's a very nice thing. I'll say that. So Prada, if you're listening and you want to sponsor the podcast, we'll totally, you know, we're good. I'm sure many of my listeners would rush to buy Prada things if there was an ad here. And Rolex, I'm not too proud, you know, I'll do it. Timex, Rolex, whatever. We're all good. You know, it's all fine. So, okay. So we're running up on time. Now you're on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
Oh, I think it's Kimberly K. Hong. Okay. Let me look.
K-A-Y or just the letter K?
Just the letter K.
Okay. I'll put it in the show notes. And then you mentioned your Instagram. Do you have, like fun pictures of food and stuff on Instagram?
I'm locked out of my Instagram. I think my account was hacked, so I don't have access to it anymore.
Okay. So we won't boost your Instagram.
Although if there's anyone who works for Instagram, I've been trying to get back in for several weeks now and I can't. So if someone can help me, that would be great.
Okay. Insta people, you know, get on it. You have a website, which I think is it's your full name, right? Kimberly K.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
.com. Check that out. This was so much fun. The book is called Spiderweb Capitalism, How Global Elites Exploit Frontier Markets. Kimberly K. Hong, thanks so much for joining me today. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your really engaging questions. They make me feel excited about this book coming out.
You should be excited because it's a really good book. So people should go buy it. That's what I have to say about it. Thanks again.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fossa. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.